There isn't a lot of sound when we're weaving, except maybe the pull of the wool on wool, which kindain da ad yochetu asaku, yeth nachatziti, dakdain tan ayachet. Deach hit dach ayachet, kashai hit ka tak hit, dleit ka yadi ayachetzu. My name is Lily Hope. I'm a Chilkat and Ravenstail weaver in Juneau, Alaska. My Tlingit name is Wishkin Dain Da'at. I'm Raven Duck Dain Tong from the Snail House. I come from both Man's Head House and Snail House. And my father is Dleit Ka.
That's 8 stitches.
Here on the loom, we have a Chilkat blanket in progress. It starts with a raven's tail pattern. We have Chilkat motifs, a profile face, some eyes, some split U shapes that are all familiar in Northwest Coast art, but they have been slightly adapted to be weavable, so we don't go nuts while we're weaving. It is hours and hours and hours. 1 square inch of Chilkat weaving can be upwards of 3 hours in the making. The little fringes are decorated with 22 magnum bullet shells, and when they are moved, the fringe, you know, they move next to each other and have this rain-like sound. We spend 2 years growing these babies, I like to say. It's almost like a surrogate. And then this little being is cut free from the frame where it was woven and placed on the shoulders of a dancer, and it's really like watching your child take its first steps. My mother was Clarissa Rizal. She was a renowned regalia maker and artist weaver in her own right. She passed away about 3 years ago, and she was constantly teaching, and I had no idea. For the 20 years leading up to her passing, she was always inviting me to, you know, stir this dye pot. You want to see how this blue comes out? Isn't this cool? Oh, look, we're going to go harvest bark. You want to come with me and do this thing? And, you know, every time I was like, sure, I'd love to hang out with you. That'd be really fun. Sounds like a good adventure. And then she passed, and I was halfway done with my first Chilkat blanket. And I was like, wait, don't go yet. Hold on. I'm not quite ready. And I had to be ready because she left. It was a good 6 weeks or so after she passed, and I sat down to weave, and I put my hands to the warp and grabbed some weaver strands and broke down, and I couldn't move. I was like, how am I supposed to move forward without her? I called a friend, and I said, what do I do? And he said, you go to the back side of your loom. Chilkat weavings are the veil between our physical and spiritual realms. When we go to the backside of the loom, that's the closest us humans can get to that ethereal realm, to the spirit world. And he said, why don't you just sit on the backside of your loom and put up all those little ends in the back with your needle and see how that feels. 4 days later of putting up all those ends, because I had half of a robe finished and all the little ends needed to go up, on that fourth day, I had this waterfall, almost like river of emotion and memories of my mother and I throughout her whole life, from my birth till her passing, all of those rushing through me from the back to the front into the robe itself. And I just cried and cried and cried. And then I cleared up and took a deep breath and went, oh, now I can weave. I know what I'm supposed to be doing.
Some days we have 6 giant ships in here. It stimulates an incredible economy. You know, there's just thousands and thousands of people from May 1st to October 2nd coming into town on a daily basis. My name's Jason Boone. I work for Juneau Tours and Whale Watch and sell tours to all these wonderful cruise ship passengers that dump off the ships every day. You want to go out to the glacier, maybe go whale watching and do something fun today?
Man, we've done all that. I'm just hanging out going to the Red Dog, you know.
Okay, Red Dog Saloon, that's a big attraction here.
Yeah, it always is, yeah.
Pat Delahunty, I'm from near Riverside, California. We got here at 7:30 this morning. We leave about 10 o'clock tonight, so it's about 14 hours in Juneau. This is one of their longest stops. And from here we go to the Tracy Arm. And so we see some glaciers in the ship. And these ships are neat because they can position themselves where you can see a glacier or two of them, and they can rotate the ship around so you don't even have to leave your stateroom. You can sit there in your room on your patio and enjoy your breakfast or a drink or whatever and watch all the scenery go by you.
The cruise ship passengers, I only get a glimpse of them, but the migrant workers that come here, I've met some of my best friends in the world. You know, we've experienced such incredible things together. The Northern Lights. I've taken airboat rides around glaciers. I've seen bears and eagles and things that people just dream of seeing. My story, I lost everything in a natural disaster, in a tornado in Florida. So I kind of picked up the pieces of my life and then all of a sudden had this opportunity to come to Alaska and work, and hey, why not?
Talk about how much longer you're going to be here this year and where you're headed next.
After I leave Juneau, I'm going to visit some friends in Colorado, visit some friends in Vegas, visit some friends in California. You know, I'm not in a rush to get back to Florida. But when I do get back to Florida, I hope to have a margarita in my hand and be on the beach for a little while before I then go to Savannah and do another work gig.
What street is this that your booth faces out onto?
I'm right here on Franklin Street. They call me the T-shirt company booth because I'm right in front of the T-shirt company.
This entire stretch, many blocks in a row, is like one giant gift and souvenir shop.
Oh, absolutely, and not to mention all the jewelry stores. But a lot of this just becomes a ghost town as soon as the cruise ships leave October 1st. And October 1st is my date out of here as well. We're all out of here. We're all going on vacation and on new adventures. We'll be back next year.
For me, my neighborhood is mostly this, outside, where I have this amazing rainforest that we live in, where we have this awesome blanketing mattress of moss-covered ground that's always soft underfoot, and where I can just hear nature being what it is. My name is Stacy Eldemar, and we are at the Mendenhall Glacier in the Tongass National Forest, the Tlingit, my tribe called this Sit, which is the word for glacier, and we are walking a trail where the glacier once stood. Thick. The glacier has receded a mile and a half in my lifetime. I judge it by the rock outcrop, and the ice was on that rock outcrop when I was young. And it's really hit me in the last decade where I'm seeing it like a dying grandfather. I considered the glacier probably my oldest, dearest, most trusted friend, and to see it dying is heartbreaking. That said, perhaps it is time for this glacier to die, and it will come again in my tiny, minuscule blink of a life. That brings me comfort. Looking for Devil's Club. Devil's Club has many purposes. In the old ways, Devil's Club would be mounted above the entryways of doorways and essentially does not allow any bad spirits into the house because the thorns will essentially grab any of the bad spirits and will not allow them into your house. So in the fall, I harvest a Devil's Club stalk from the woods. It serves as a protection, a reminder to be mindful in where I am, and becomes part of my, you know, my venturing meditation. And I think we'll go ahead and take this. And as much as, yeah, don't handle Devil's Club with your bare hands, I still like to feel if it's friendly towards me, and this one is. And Raven approves. And then this is where the leather glove comes in. Okay. Oh, that smell is marvelous.
Gunnish chish sa'acht. Gunnish chish.
My name's Matt Robus, and we're in my living room here in Juneau, Alaska. When I retired, I was the director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Juneau's built right at the shoreline, and bears go up and down the hill during their seasonal activities, and they go up on the hill for grass in the spring, they come down to the creeks and the shore early in the year, and then they're in mid-slope for berries, and then they hit the streams for salmon. Well, we built a town right in the middle of that, and so they are forced to come into close contact with people multiple times through the year. But when you have them in the center of a community, eventually, you know, something needs to be resolved. And we had a bear in a neighborhood, and eventually we got a call that this bear was up in a tree asleep. An assistant and myself rolled out there and got out of the truck, and sure enough, there's this bear, and it's probably about 20 feet up in the tree. And I loaded a dart and got ready to immobilize it, knowing it would fall out of the tree. But black bears are amazingly tough animals. They just kind of bounce off of things and usually are okay. As I got ready to raise the gun and take the shot, I realized there were kind of a line of people from the neighborhood standing around behind us, and I asked them to stand clear and whatever, and one of them piped up and said, "Isn't that bear going to fall on the ground after you dart it?" And I said, "Well, yes." "Well, will you give us like 10 minutes and we'll all go to our houses and get mattresses and we'll come out and we'll make a pile of mattresses on the ground underneath the bear?" And sure enough, within 15 minutes, we had this big pile of mattresses underneath this tree, and the bear is still asleep. And so I darted the bear, and when that dart hit into the front shoulder, the bear was really startled, and it stood up on the branch. And then it became evident that that bear had been there a long time, because the first thing it did was it started peeing. And it kept at it for a good long time. And all of these people who had just been starry-eyed a moment before were starting to react to what was happening to the mattresses that they'd put under this bear. My assistant and I are standing there facing away from these people, just going, oh, God, what are we going to do? And the bear finally went to sleep after 6 or 7 minutes, tumbled down, hit at the edge of the mattresses, so they may have done some good. And usually when you approach an immobilized animal, you do it very, very carefully, and you probe them a time or two to make sure they're not going to come at you. This time, we each just grabbed a handful of fur and ran and threw it in the pickup truck and booked out of the neighborhood. But that was kind of the moment I remember in my career when it was like, this can't be happening, but it is. What are we going to do? So, there you go. One of the things that strikes you about that whole deal is that you think you're going into a profession where you're going to be dealing with animals all the time, and in fact, most of wildlife management is dealing with people one way or the other. Basically, we humans create the problem and the bears usually suffer for it. So it's a checkered, confusing thing to deal with.
So he's going to want to deliver his fish because the storm is coming in. So he's going to tie up. I'm going to start the boat. We're going to get his fish.
So what are we looking at here in this bag?
Okay, these are cohos, and the weight on it is 228 pounds.
My name is Mark Butchkowski.
Is this boat a regular stop for you tendering is what's going on here, right?
Yeah.
What do you got there? That's your ticket?
That's the paperwork, yeah.
Okay, and that tells you what?
That tells me it was a bad day of fishing.
I mean, to someone like me, 220 pounds is pretty impressive. That's not...
You put that on the air? Jeez, oh, Pete.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
I'm Bonnie Millard, and we're in Juneau, Alaska.
We're on the fishing vessel San Juan, which is my boat. It's a 48-foot Delta. I commercial fish with it and also tender.
Hey.
I got you, Bob.
Yeah, don't bother looking for me. The few I have on board, I'm not going to worry about, but I might go back out tomorrow, the next day.
Okay, well, just give me a heads up if you do, Tim.
Roger that. I'll talk to you later.
So the gillnetters go out and they fish for salmon, and then it's up to the tendermen to come and get their fish so that they can continue fishing. So the tenderman gets the fish and then takes them back to the plant. And these days we try to make that happen every other day so the fish is really fresh when it hits the market.
Today you're tendering. Other days you're going out yourself and you're doing that long lining and you're filling up your own hole with your own fish.
Yeah, tendering is not fishing. But I've had to diversify to keep this boat working, because a boat costs a tremendous amount of money. I always laugh because I'll be working on my boat, I'll have my coveralls on and everything, and somebody walks by and goes, "God, your boat just looks amazing." And I think, well, what about me? I mean, if I spent this kind of money on myself, I'd look really amazing, you know, but I spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on this thing, you know, so it's, I always think it's pretty funny. And it's just a tremendous amount of work.
Tell me your husband's name.
Pat Millard. I met Pat, so my boat and motor were running, and his wasn't running, so he said, "Why don't you take me out fishing?" And I said, "Well, if you're going to go out fishing, you better be at the dock at 4:30 in the morning. Otherwise, I'm leaving." You know. So anyway, there he was, and we went fishing together that day, and that was it. So,
as they say, he was a keeper.
He was a keeper. So yes, he was. So when we trolled for salmon off the coast of Alaska, and we had just gotten done with a big trip, and the hold was full of fish, and we were cleaning the boat up to head to town to unload to the cold storage, because when you go to town, you do your laundry, you do your grocery shopping, you take showers, you go out to dinner, and you know, it's just kind of a fun time, so it's just all getting your laundry together. And I was downstairs changing sheets and all that stuff, and when I came back up, Pat was nowhere to be seen. He fell off the boat, and we never saw him. It just, like, 4 minutes, it just, like, vanished from the face of the earth. So that really changed my life a lot. It was an overwhelming thing to go through.
What was it like for you to head out on the boat solo after losing him?
It was real emotional. A lot of time was spent on the ocean, and of course it's just beautiful out there, and you know, it was pretty teary-eyed a lot. Didn't know what I was doing half the time, but you're there, so you have to do it. So that's how it worked.
And you've been doing it on your own for how long now?
I think 40 years, oh my goodness. So yeah.
What an interesting relationship you must have with the water. I mean, the water is what brought you and your husband together. The water is what took your husband from you. The water is how you make a living. I mean, talk about your relationship with the sea.
I love the ocean. Sometimes when it's just terrible, blowing and raining and rough and everything's breaking and everything, I just think my love affair with the ocean is over now. You know, so there I go back again, and so I'm constantly Mother Nature and I, we have an agreement, you know, we like each other. So that's a good thing. But the sea is I really like the ocean. I never get tired of it.
It's out of the blocks.
Juneau, Alaska.
One neighborhood.
Everybody's story.
Everybody's story.
Everybody's story.
anger, fear,
confusion,
elation,
happiness and joy,
sadness,
excitement,
frustration. There are times where I go weeks or months without noticing the rhythms that my body's making through breathing or my footsteps or anything when I'm running. And then there's other times where I'm really focused on one or the other of those things. But it, often for me, running up and down, like if I'm going up a steep trail or down a steep trail, I feel like I can kind of use it as a tool to get into a place mentally and psychologically where suddenly what I'm doing doesn't feel physically difficult anymore. I'm Jeff Rose, and I'm an avid mountain trail long-distance runner. When I was racing, I was specializing in kind of 50 and 100-mile distances was really what I focused on. I don't run that far anymore, and the main reason I don't race much anymore is because you really need to put most everything else in your life on hold to be prepared to do it at the level that I was trying to do it, as high of a level as possible. And in terms of time that it took up, it was at least 40 or 50 hours a week. 2 years in a row, I was voted North American Ultra Runner of the Year, which I'm proud of. I don't mean to downplay it, but it certainly wasn't why I did it. But I had a lot of success in the sport, and especially at the 100-mile distance, was able to do quite well in most any races that I ran. Of the races I've done, my finishing time has ranged between 15 hours and 25 hours for 100 miles. You might feel horrible for 6 or 8 hours in the midst of a run, but the larger picture of the entire run, if it's a 15 or 20-hour race, you might have a great race in which you feel horrible for several hours and still have a really good race. You know, sometimes the last mile or two of the race, I feel like I'm just like holding back tears the entire time. There's so much emotion in the accomplishment or in just being relieved that it's done. And I've had other times when I finish and I just kind of find the whole thing really humorous, and I'm just kind of laughing as I'm crossing the finish line because it's kind of a silly thing to do in some ways. And sometimes every maybe two or three races that I've done, I've not wanted it to end yet, and there's been a little bit of sort of a feeling of like, oh, I wish there was 5 more miles or whatever. And I sort of started running long distances with this idea that it would be such a way to tap into my individual inner strength and power, but it has surprised me how my main deep inner takeaway from it has been the kind of the opposite of that. It's been how it connects me to other people and connects me to the land.
My name is James Hoagland, and I like to say that I create the illusion of Gigi Monroe. I will start with my foundation that covers, you know, a little bit of stubble and start to draw on the contours of a feminine face. Gigi Monroe is a drag queen. That's my drag persona. And as her, I create drag shows and mentor young performers. It's like that 2 hours once a month that people can take and just enjoy a spectacle, you know, with all different kinds of acts and different kinds of music, but something that allows them to just have a release. This is an interesting community for LGBTQ people because, like in a lot of rural places, younger folks come out and leave. Lately, I've been doing a teal, kind of a peacock blue almost color on my eyelid that's covered in the same color glitter. So when I blink, it's a very sparkly flash of peacock blue, which is very exciting. I came to Juneau literally on a cruise ship. I was working as a costume supervisor for Norwegian Cruise Lines. And so every Tuesday from 2 p.m. to 8 p.m., I would be in Juneau. I was also single, and I met a guy in port who I went on a coffee date with, And we started seeing each other every Tuesday from 2 to 8 that I was in town. And then at the end of the summer, I thought of just moving to Juneau and seeing what would happen, both with the relationship and as a drag queen and as a queer man in his early 30s, you know, trying to settle down. So that was 6 years ago.
Tell me what happened with that relationship.
3 years ago, we got married. I'll add fake lashes. I will draw on oversized lips. And that is my face. You know, we like to quote Dolly Parton by saying, the higher the hair, the closer to God. But I just always loved wigs. I liked all kinds of wigs, every kind of color and texture, curly, straight, wavy. At some point, I realized that this was something that I had taught myself so that I could do my own hair, but it was something that other queens really needed help with. And so I started just styling a few, and then I would post pictures of them online, say they were up for sale, and I would get instant sales. That's grown into a full-time business today, and I ship out 30 to 40 wigs a month. This is my most popular design. As you can see, I've cut all the hair off the base wig. And then I pin on 5 ponytails. That means that I can get huge volume. And then, of course, the ever-important hairspray. There is a theme that runs through my whole life that is living at the intersections. So whether it's male and female, living here in Alaska, you know, the wilderness and the city, I'm really at the intersection and I can be a bridge. That's my intention, and I hope that that's what I can leave this world knowing that I had an impact by being a bridge between communities and people.
My name is Chris Talley, also known as Radiophonic Oddity, or RPO. We're currently in my home studio, or my bedroom, you know. Got the business license, but also got the bed in the corner, you know. I'm a rapper, I'm a beatboxer, I'm an actor, I'm really just an entertainer. See, my town is a speck, where respect is at a minimal. Judging from your clothes, you'll get pegged as a criminal. Literally bull, good workers ain't chosen. Get a bad rep, just suspect, pinned as homeless. Always keep on spitting rhymes or written, get attention. Got respect from the peers who can see me on my mission. Might tell you a little something about my town. When you got loyal friends, they never let you down. Ayy. This is an Everlast Choice of Champions bag, made in the USA. Of course, red and black stripe.
And this is where you take out your aggression, get a little exercise in the process.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not going to lie. I used to do that on my door, and then my parents started to get mad at me.
What do you know about your birth parents?
So basically what I do know is both my parents are actually dancers. So they start off kind of like entertaining people, doing all that kind of stuff in high school and college. And then they kind of hit a heavy slope. My dad started selling drugs, and my mom started doing drugs, and one thing kind of led to the other. You know, my mom, you know, usually wouldn't pay, you know, with money to get drugs from my dad. So that's kind of how I came about. And they didn't really have the means to take care of me. You know, they both had children on their side, and they just decided, you know, just kind of give me up for adoption. I was born prematurely, so I was in kind of critical condition, kind of critical care for a while. But I was adopted by some lovely people. I believe my parents had just moved to Alaska, an all-white family, you know, and they were looking for kids who were adoption, like, you know, newborn babies. So basically they were calling, asking the hospital if they had anyone up for adoption, if there were any they didn't have any babies, you know, healthy babies that were up for adoption, but they just had a premature black baby that was just born, and they rushed up to the hospital right away. It's actually kind of funny, when they're on the way to the hospital, they got into a car accident. And a truck ran them off the side of a road, and the car flipped over maybe 5-6 times. After all that happened, the truck drove them to the Anchorage Hospital and everything, where I was being born. And You know, they look really disheveled. They just got into a car accident. So they were like, are you guys sure you're up to adopting this baby? And they're like, yes, we're sure. We're positive. So they got me, and, you know, I've been in their loving care ever since. I couldn't ask for a better family, really.
I wonder if you ever think about, like, how life would have turned out for you if you hadn't been adopted.
I actually do think of that sometimes. I would imagine that my life would have been very lonely. You know, I feel like it would have just been a lot of self-reliance. But I don't think I would have turned out any differently, honestly. I feel like I would have kind of stayed the same. Yeah.
My name is Kristi Nami Erickson. I'm a multidisciplinary poet, a teaching artist, and a community organizer. Right now, we're sitting in my home in what I call the out the road of downtown Juneau, so still walking distance, but kind of away from the beaten path a little bit, looking at the water.
You've got the clouds clinging to the side of these pine-covered mountains. I can't imagine ever getting tired of this view.
Yeah, I think things in our lives are generally a little bit cloudy, so I embrace a little bit of partly cloudy weather myself. I grew up in Juneau. I was born in Korea, but I was raised here, moved for a little while, went to school down south, you know, fell in love, did that, was there for a little bit, and then I returned to Juneau 10 years ago. You know, I was pregnant, so I think when you're pregnant, you just really want to go home. And then when I got here, I just immediately tried to start bringing back the parts that had felt home to me in Minnesota, which is where I just come from, so that I could have the best of both worlds in the same space. Kindred Post is an idea born out of what was a historically downtown post office space closing about 6 years ago. I'm the daughter of a lifelong postal employee. He's actually retired as a postmaster. And so I've always had appreciation for the postal service. And I think that, you know, when I really thought about what a post office is, I feel like at the heart of it is connection, right? It's about sending something to somebody else and somebody else receiving it. And so I opened Kindred Post, and we continue to be a post office where we offer mail services. You can buy stamps and send packages and all of that. But when I opened Kindred Post, it felt like a really natural thing to also invite a lot of poetry events into the space. When your brown son tells you over dinner he thinks he's ugly. When you stutter on your own memories. When you reach for him, a table and a canyon away. His hair in your hands. A thousand falling stars, each one a wish that has already passed. You, the color of a good luck penny. You, the color of harvest. You, the color of flight. Anorea's sun in the new world that won't want to shine on your face.
What's your son's name?
His Hispanic name is Diego, and his Korean name is Sunwoo.
Are you raising him by yourself?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm a single parent. I've been a single parent since he was about 3 weeks old. Yeah.
He's on his way home from school. He'll be home here before too long.
Yeah, he's on his way home. Hey, Sanoa. So I forgot to tell you this was happening, but I have a couple of friends here who are doing an interview. Hello. You want to be a part of it?
Hello. Nice to meet you.
Good to meet you.
Let me invite you to introduce yourself. Tell me your name. Tell me how old you are.
Diego, and I'm 10 years old.
What do you want us to know about Juneau?
It's great and really cold. Sometimes sunny, but I hate it when it's sunny, and sometimes I like it when it's sunny. Sometimes you could fall down and see birds above in the sky, and they're swirling above you.
You sound like a poet yourself. I think you just made a poem.
No, I didn't make a poem. I just thought of something that happened. What was your favorite part of the day?
My favorite part of the day today. Thanks for asking. I really loved my walk to work today because on my way to work, my phone died. And so I put it all away, and then I just walked to work listening to the sounds of everything around me. And then for some reason, I don't do that often enough. Felt really good.
Cool. You've been listening
to Out of the Blocks. From radio producer Aaron Henkin and music producer Wendell Patrick.
Special thanks to field producer M.K. McNaughton and KTOO Public Media.
Aaron and Wendell want to thank all of us who took a leap of faith and shared our stories and our lives.
For WYPR and PRX,
this is Juneau, Alaska. Signing off.
Signing off.
Coming up next time on Out of the Blocks, we've got more stories for you from Juneau, Alaska, including a visit to Thunder Mountain High School, where Kyle Worrell coaches a local Native Youth Olympics team.
There's this sport based on indigenous games that were used by hunters to test skills of strength and agility and to help them be better hunters and live out on the land. So this is one of our early practices. We just started our season. And right now they're doing the 1 foot high kick. So the 1 foot is a form of sign language that was used long ago to communicate across the tundra of a successful hunt. And you could see someone do a high kick like this from the distance. And it was a good sign. It meant a successful hunt.
Young athletes, old hunters, a love story, a cabin on an island, a gourmet chef, an obsessed cyclist, and a roller derby girl on the next Out of the Blocks. Special thanks go out to the NEA for making our Juneau episodes possible, and we also want to say thanks to you for listening. If you appreciate what we do here on the podcast and you're in the mood to do us a favor, there is an easy way to help us out. Click onto Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. Or even easier, just tell a friend to check us out. Thanks for spreading the good word about Out of the Blocks. Thanks for listening, and we'll do it again soon.
I'm speaking with Aaron Henkin, producer of the podcast Out of the Blocks, and M.K. McNaughton, artist and Juneau local. Our listeners just heard the first of two episodes that focused on Juneau, Alaska, more specifically on our people. Aaron and M.K., when did you collect these interviews?
Oh, boy. I guess it was in September. Does that sound right to you, M.K.?
It does, middle of September, right after our beautiful summer of sun. They came the week it started raining.
That's right. That's the week that I learned the Alaskan term sucker hole from MK. Yes. A little spot of sunshine and an otherwise rainy week, but it was beautiful nonetheless.
They never saw the mountains, but lots of whales.
They never saw the mountains.
No.
That's, oh, you're just going to have to come back.
A reason to come back, yeah.
Yeah. And MK, what did your role as field producer entail?
Well, I had a great task of finding people and inviting them to participate and then scheduling. And then Aaron is so open-ended, he gave me the option of participating in interviews or not, just giving them the addresses. But I ended up tagging along for the whole week because it was so much fun to be with them.
Oh, I bet. It sounds like an amazing job. I'm a little jealous. Aaron, first and foremost, thank you for visiting our town and putting together these voices. I'm also excited to talk to you about the making of this show, but let's start with a little bit about you. How often do you get to be the interviewee?
Not often. I'm much more comfortable on your end of the studio table. Yeah, I feel like my job is to listen to other people. I often wonder if I have anything worthwhile to say, but hopefully I will.
Well, tell me a bit about yourself. Where are you based out of, and how did you get into podcasting?
Mm-hmm. So I'm speaking to you out of the National Public Radio affiliate down here in Baltimore, Maryland, WYPR. I've been here, I guess, almost 20 years now. I started here as a volunteer with no official training of any sort. I learned everything on the job, and eventually they started letting me make my own original radio programs. And, yeah, this project, Out of the Blocks, is sort of the most recent iteration of what they permit me to do around here. It's, you know, the premise of the thing is really simple. It started here in Baltimore. Each episode, we make it our mission to go to one city block in Baltimore and just post up and meet as many people as we can on that block and interview them about their slice of life, and then obviously what you hear is a collage of all their stories that gives you a bigger sense of that place. It started as a radio show, and then, like the rest of the public radio world, we eventually got pulled kicking and screaming into the world of podcasting, and now this thing exists. More people listen to it on podcasts than hear it on the radio. And I should say also that we've gotten an opportunity through the National Endowment for the Arts to take this documentary model to other places around the country, which was our excuse to come visit you guys.
How many episodes are there? What's the beginning? And also, how or where will it end?
That's a very good question. I ask myself that question often. I think we're on like 75 episodes at this point. It's been going. The first one we made, I think, was about 6 years ago now. They used to be much more sort of farther and fewer and farther between. But we got organized, we got grant funded, and then it went, we would put one out every couple of months. And now we have a podcast where an episode releases every 2 weeks. People really respond to it. I think people get really surprised by it. The format, the concept, the sort of the fact that it doesn't have a narrator, that you just get dropped into this world and are sort of left to your own interpretive powers to make what you will of it.
So that's 6 years, 75 episodes. Are those all in different locations, or were some of those in the beginning in Baltimore only?
Yeah, well, for several years, it was just Baltimore. So if you go back, to the beginning of our archive, it's all Baltimore episodes. And then I guess maybe about 3 years ago is when we started getting funding to go to other cities. We've been to St. Louis, Chicago, Atlanta, Detroit, Oakland, California. We did an episode on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. We just recorded in Charleston, West Virginia. So, on it goes.
Has the format evolved over time?
Well, I think we've gotten smarter about, our work process. But really, I hope the idea has stayed pretty constant. And that is that, when you show up and meet someone, we have the radical agenda of having no agenda when we show up. And so, the first kinds of questions I ask, sometimes all you have to ask is, tell me about yourself. And then you just listen actively and honor your own curiosity and let the conversation go where this person wants to go with it.
And what was that experience like here in Juneau? Actually, I'd like MK to chime in on this. How easy or difficult was it to get folks to speak with you?
Well, I think everybody I asked agreed, and I did ask people who... some of them tend to be kind of shy people. So as it got close to the interviewee time, a couple of people were pretty freaked out. Like, oh no, why did I agree to do this? And then as soon as they meet Aaron and Wendell, everybody was like puppies, like who just kind of rolled over with their paws up in the air. Because Aaron and Wendell are totally easy to be around. And Wendell, I didn't realize they were going to take photos also. Uh-huh. And I hadn't told people that, but Wendell just completely disarmed people. He's like the camera whisperer. Like, it came in with his charm. And so there was not a peep of discontent about the photos either, which are beautiful. So, I think that they just made it really easy for folks.
You did, seemed like you did most of these interviews on location, where your subject was out in the field or at their homes. What was important about being in their space?
Now, that's a great question. Well, there are a couple of benefits to that. And I also just want to say very briefly, MK mentioned the name Wendell. Wendell Patrick is my co-producer. I keep saying we. That's me and Wendell when I say we. Wendell is an electronic musician, composer, a classically trained pianist. In Baltimore, great photographer, and has been my partner on this project ever since the beginning. He creates an original musical score that you hear behind everybody in each episode. So in terms of meeting people where they are, it's sonically such a richer experience because you can build scenes into these audio portraits, whether it's Lily Hope at her loom and you hear the sound of the wool getting woven in, whether it's, you know, on the boat with Bonnie Millard while she's taking in some fish from another guy who's been out fishing. It gives you, you know, radio can really paint very vivid pictures for the mind if you put the right sounds in and then invite the people to explain what's making those sounds. You know, I oftentimes hear myself saying to people, paint a picture with words what you're doing right now. Give me an audio tour of this space. And the other thing is that when you are visiting someone on their home turf, they've got the home field advantage, so to speak, and they're more comfortable. You know, as awkward as it is to have someone, you know, stick a microphone in your face, you know, at least you're in your own space and we're their visitors there, so they're a little bit more in power in that relationship.
When you parachute into a community and start asking questions or start asking for interviews, how do you make sure you do that in a thoughtful way?
It's a complicated question, and, you know, it's always a work in progress. We don't pretend to have this all figured out. When we do travel to other cities, like Juneau, we do have the benefit of teaming up with a local field producer who we entrust with that sort of curatorial capacity of, you know, who do we want to meet? Who's going to make for an interesting cross-section of human beings around here? It has to do with just listening actively and trying to be a surrogate for your audience. And, you know, there's no denying our own subjectivity. Any one of us who goes to interview someone, there'll be questions that I'll ask. There'll be questions that I will innately, subconsciously neglect to ask. I mean, any one of us could interview someone and end up with, you know, that many different interviews. And then when you factor in the editing, you take that hour-long conversation and cut it into 3.5 minutes or 4 minutes, you know, that's another, you know, factor of decisions that have been made about this person's portrait. So it is through, you know, my lens, and I just, you know, I always keep in mind, you know what, that this person who this story is about is going to hear this along with everyone else. And am I comfortable with the idea of them hearing the audio portrait that I painted for them? And if, you know, hopefully the answer is yes.
I thought about that a lot, too, when they invited me to be the field producer. And I wanted to tell a story that was interesting to both people from Baltimore and, oh, like, why would they want to listen to a story about Juneau, Alaska? And then for Junoites, like, why would we want to hear a story, you know? And so a mix of, you know, bears and cabins and hunters, things that are sort of iconic Alaskan, and respect for the people who have been here, Tlingit artists, leaders, and then also some of the unsung heroes. And there was a great moment in my studio just a few weeks ago at a First Friday Art Walk when one of the participants came in, Jeff Rose. He's this ultra runner that I feel like people don't know about. And I said, Jeff, what did you think of the podcast? And he said, oh, yeah, it was fun. It was great. He's very shy. And his wife was with him, and she said, what? You were in a podcast? And I said, you didn't tell your wife? And she said, oh, he's like that, you know, where it races and people come up because he's pretty famous in his field. Mm-hmm. But he's very uncomfortable with that. And he was so uncomfortable while she was telling me that story. Yeah, it was great.
Cat's out of the bag now.
Yeah, yeah.
Aaron, you mentioned asking questions and then listening actively. I think active listening is a skill that's so important but so difficult. I struggle with it myself all the time. Any pro tips you'd like to share?
Sometimes the simplest follow-up questions are the best. Some of my favorite follow-up questions are why, or what happened next? you know, these interviews that we do, they're two phases. One of them is kind of the fishing around to get a story rolling part of the interview, and that just involves throwing out a lot of different kind of story prompts. And then once you realize that you've got, you know, that kind of fish on the line in the way of a, you know, a compelling story that's piqued your curiosity, you change hats and become almost more of like an on-site story coach. Sometimes I'll use directorial language once we're really into the details of a story, you know. Rewind to the beginning of that day. Tell me how you felt there. Let's pause here and zoom in. Paint a picture of, you know, what was going through your mind then. What happened next? You know, elicit sensory details. And then, you know, as we have the luxury of pre-recording, so I can ask the same question several different ways and get all these moments so that I can, you know, then take that palette of elements and cut it into, you know, a sort of a really compelling narrative arc. And then to, you know, give them an opportunity to have a moment of reflection at, you know, at the end of their story or their interview. MK will tell you, she probably got tired of hearing me ask this, but I like to finish conversations. I like to say, if you think about your life as a story, what do you think the moral of your story is? And it's a great way to get people to have that moment of reflection. That's oftentimes the sort of beautiful sort of period at the end of their sentence. Or sometimes I'll take that and I'll put it right at the beginning. So you hear that moment of reflection before you even hear them introduce themselves.
It's a nice gift of a question that lasts past the interview, too. I noticed watching Aaron and Wendell that in the interviews, Aaron's not afraid to ask questions that are personal or direct. And in, you know, polite conversation, sometimes when people get into something that's difficult, we as listeners like sort of veer away from that. And in these interviews, there's sometimes for me a breathtaking moment where you just asked a question that took us farther into that topic. We're talking about dying, a partner mm-hmm. dying, or difficult subjects. And that's a really great gift, too, in being a good listener and not being afraid to hear the real story, I think.
Thank you so much for tuning in today to this special edition of Juno Afternoon featuring full-length episode of Out of the Blocks Part 1. Part 2 airs tomorrow, Friday, January 3rd, and will feature the voices of Kurt Iverson, Rosita Worrell, Lionel Udipa, George Kuhar, and more. It will also feature Part 2 of my interview with M.K. McNaughton and Aaron Hinken. Thanks for listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. Until tomorrow, have a great Juno evening. Thank you.